Good morning. It's June 19th, Juneteenth, and this is week 24 of the Zogby Report, Real and Unscripted. This is John Zogby and my son Jeremy, and each week we take a look at the news and take a look at what's behind the news. And wow, Jared, what a 24 weeks this has been. These are moments in history that we're living in real time. So let's try to get right into it. What we like to do normally, because we're in the midst of a presidential election, is just do a quick update so that folks have a sense of what's going on, how we see it. So in our latest polls, we show that Joe Biden is leading President Trump by 13 percentage points and actually polling over 50%, a higher number than Hillary Clinton ever saw against Donald Trump. And in our special poll, which we're going to talk about a little bit later on in this podcast, which we conducted in conjunction with Forbes, we show President Biden, Vice President Biden, hitting the magic number of 60%. In support against Donald Trump, and Donald Trump down to 31. So almost a 30-point lead, which is kind of, I guess, what you would call an Obama number. But those numbers are really confirmed by other polls that are out there. We're right in the mainstream. And at this moment in time, on average, Biden leads nationally by around 8.5 to 9 percentage points on average, and leads in 6 battleground states, all 6 battleground states that folks are most closely watching, and competitive in some states like Georgia and Arizona, which really have not been traditionally battleground states. So at this moment in time, let's just say it's been a bad few weeks for President Trump. It's been a triumphant few weeks for former Vice President Joe Biden. But then, of course, Jeremy, the election is not today and it's not over, is it?
It's definitely not over. By the way, the poll that we've been doing monthly, once again, is of likely voters age 18 to 29. Mm-hmm. And so there is no surprise that Biden is in the lead. But I'll tell you what I thought was surprising was after we asked the likely voters who they would vote for if the election were held today, we then followed up with, well, how strong is your support? Could you change your mind or is it impossible? Overall, 41% said that they could change their mind. 53% said it was impossible. Let's drill down a little bit further. Let's look at those who select Biden. 43% say they could change their mind. 51% say that it would be impossible to change their mind. And then on the flip side, looking at those who say they would vote for Trump if the election were held today, 38% say they could change their mind, and 57% report that it's impossible. That is intriguing. That I could, you know, go on a few different angles, but I think I would say, just looking at the big picture, I don't think 18 to 29 year olds necessarily have their mind made up. It could be because of all the uncertainty. That's a cloud of uncertainty over the heads. Even though it sounds like Biden really has it with 60%, what that tells me is this could all change. And of course it could change. Just look at what's happened since January. What else is to come? I think that's what's on the minds of voters, that if from January till today in June has been this hectic, what's it going to be like today until November? What's your take on that?
Is that this is fluid. Yes, if the election were held today, I think that we could see a Biden blowout. But again, the election is not today. And the campaign in earnest has not really begun yet, meaning that there's a lot of negative campaigning that will happen, because simply it always does. And we already have the strong sense from the Trump people that they're going to go after Biden in a very big way. They're going to go after him as a hypocrite. they're going to go after him on his positions on the crime reform bill in the 1990s, going to go after him as having possible dementia, whatever. This is all, unfortunately, fair game in U.S. politics. Of course, meanwhile, Biden's people are going to be going after Trump as well for a whole bunch of things, not the least of which is a whole laundry list of things that are coming out about the president in former National Security Advisor John Bolton's book. And so you're going to see a lot of punching and counterpunching. And I think it's safe to at least conjecture that young people are not going to flock more than likely to Donald Trump. The issue is if enough dirt can be thrown at Biden so that pretty much the same thing happens in 2020 that happened in 2016, where young people say, look, I don't really like either of these guys, and I don't really think I'm even going to bother to vote. I think that's the dynamic we're looking at. And just one final point, in addition to bad weeks for Trump, good weeks for Biden, we have a level of protest and a level of interest in things politic among young people and among suburban women, two very important target groups for Democrats. And the, you know, a question will be, can that level of enthusiasm be sustained?
That's a great point. Regarding whether or not the 18 to 29 year olds would even show up. And we could look at it two different ways. Maybe they just, a lot of them will say, we don't have hope in either candidate, or there is the small possibility that the Green Party candidate or the Libertarian Party candidate, Joe Jorgensen, could take a sliver of that. Right now, our poll shows that they both stand at about 2%, but there's always that wild card possibility. You just never know. And there was another topic in the poll that was very intriguing, and it was on police and racism. And we had a line of questions, and I'm going to share these results, and probably a lot of people are going to think that they're contradictory, but I think I see what's going on here. And so I'll just rattle off this data. And so regarding whether or not 18 to 29-year-olds believe that police brutality is mainly a threat to people of color or a threat to all races, this is something that we were talking about a few weeks ago. A majority, 53%, say a threat mainly to people of color, yet 39% believe that police brutality is a threat to all races. We then followed up with, what about systemic racism throughout America today? Well, there was really not too much disagreement on that. 77% agree, and of that, 56% strongly agree, 21% somewhat agree that systemic racism is throughout the country. It is a major issue. But when we follow up on this angle or this news story, which is really heating up, and this is, you know, gone back decades, it popped up back in, I'd say, around the time Ferguson and Baltimore and those riots happened, a very intense debate over, should we even have Confederate flags? Should we even have Confederate memorials and statues in this country? And this is where there's a real interesting turn among Gen Z and millennials, who, no doubt about it, are in agreement that there's systemic racism. And many of them believe that, in particular, police brutality is a threat to African Americans. But when we ask them, do these Confederate symbols of statues, monuments, and flags still have a space or a place in the public space? A plurality of 48% disagree, but 45% agree. There's a split down the middle. Now, what does that mean? And my take on it is that there's a sizable enough group within the Gen Z and millennials. And I think often people tend to think that they're uniform and that they're, you know, very left or very progressive. But I think that this split, those who agree that there is a place in public spaces for these kind of Confederate symbols, they agree because, that's a part of the First Amendment. And I would take it even further that I would say some of those also think that the Confederate legacy in itself can be a way to educate citizens about the horrors of slavery. It's not so much that you just rip them down because they're offensive, but these are monuments to our past, a very dark past that could serve to teach us so that we don't repeat, as history tends to do, it tends to repeat itself when people choose not to learn from it.
So this is layered, but to comment briefly on it, first of all, when you take a look at this group, 18 to 29-year-olds, almost half, not quite half, are persons of color, are African-American, Latino, Asian, and mixed. And so that could be one source of this kind of even split. I don't think it's purely that way. I think that there are some who jump over to the other side of the question. I think a second thing is clearly generational in the sense that I'm recalling when I polled the 1996 election, that was Bill Clinton versus Bob Dole. Bob Dole had been widely revered as a World War II hero, lost the use of his arm, in fact. And yet, by 1996, when he tried to run as a World War II hero, that time had come and gone. And for younger voters at that time, World War II could have been the Peloponnesian War, could have been the 30 Years War. It was long ago, and the intimacy of the occasion just didn't hit them. And I'm thinking here that while there's a great intensity on the side of those who want the statues and the symbols to come down, that's what's moving this issue. Those who have a tendency to say, well, keep them up, because they are a sign of history, they are a reminder, may very well include a large number of people who just really don't know the full meaning of what the Confederacy meant.
Well, I can't speak for the South, but I know growing up in the Northeast that the Civil War was always that one lesson, as well as World War II. For some reason, the Revolution was interesting, but in World War One, really, in many ways, is the forgotten war. But when it came to World War Two, and when it came to the Civil War, that's what I observed over my decade and a half experience in public school that piqued the interest of most in the classroom. I would suspect that that's the same in the South and other parts of the country. You know, I mean, to think that a nation fought against itself. And then, of course, everybody knows Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln is on the penny, is on the dollar. Many have been to Washington, D.C. And if you go to Washington, D.C., you can't help but see that gigantic Lincoln memorial. So I think we'll continue to keep asking that question as we inch towards the election. But there's another thing. Yeah, to track the movement. But this was a question a little bit controversial, but I thought we had to ask it because it sheds light on where people really think this nation is headed. And I was wondering whether people believe that Trump will uphold the constitutional law and the tradition of stepping down when you lose an election, or will he take drastic measures to suspend the Constitution? Split down the middle, 43% to 43% on that issue. If that's not a sign of where this country could be headed. I don't know what is.
Yeah, and that, and remember again, this is 18 to 29 year olds that we polled. So it's a sign just of how badly split this country is on lots of major issues. But in particular, what we're talking about are questions that have only really arisen in the last few years about winning an election, losing an election. Is the winner legitimate? Is the loser supposed to concede? We are so polarized and so dug in that we have substantial numbers of people who will not recognize the legitimacy of whoever was elected. The first time I remember seeing that was in the 90s in Bill Clinton, reading about focus groups that the Wall Street Journal had done, where the folks in those focus groups who were not supporters of Clinton would call him Bill. And when asked by the focus group facilitator, why are you referring to him that way? Because I don't see him as the real president of the United States. Democrats had their turn with George W. Bush, and Republicans again had their turn, never respecting, not all, but many never respecting the fact that Barack Obama won, and even for that matter, had won twice with a majority. It's come to a head right now, of course, with Donald Trump. Still opponents that are in awe, shock that he's president of the United States, and that he is perceived to skirt all rules of engagement, skirt laws if he needs to, and his behavior is such that he kind of lends itself to this notion that he's going to flail and shadow box, and especially if the election is close, charge that the election is, or possibly charge that the election is rigged, and whether that happens or not, the very fact that these 18 to 29 year olds are split over whether that's going to happen is really very telling.
So you read a book this week and then you shared it with me and I read it. And this is from an interesting guy, Kirkpatrick Sale, who you've talked about for years. You've referenced him, a neo-Luddite, a guy who hates the machine, and he also is a separatist. He's in New Hampshire, but he wrote this book called The Collapse of 2020. This is a topic that I've been fascinated by going back to when I read Jared Diamond and even an article in Vanity Fair in maybe 2006 on the parallels between the collapse of the Roman Empire and the American Empire. And it's been, you know, one of my most favorite topics to research ever since. But this goes really beyond that. He outlines three areas of collapse: ecological, economic, and political. Dad, why don't you give our listeners your take on this very relevant topic? This is something we're hearing more and more about, and it's kind of becoming mainstream.
Yeah, you know, it all starts out with a bet that he made back in the 1990s with Kevin Kelly, who is the founder and publisher of Wired magazine and a devotee of Silicon Valley and the new economy. And Kirkpatrick Sale takes the role of Jeremiah, the prophet, preaching gloom and doom, and says, "I bet you that by 2020, all of this will fall apart." And so they took the bet. They bet $1,000. And so now this is the 2020 update. And in essence, what Kirkpatrick Sale is saying is that, all right, I lost the bet. The whole world as we know it has not fallen apart, but we're well on the way. And so he lays out the dire consequences of having ignored the signs of global warming and the devastation that could wreak. Also talks then economically about the collapse of the dollar, of going off the gold standard, and of creating lots and lots of jobs that cannot sustain the lives of people who have them and are jobs that could be and are disposable. And then thirdly, a political system that, in essence, let's say a lot of people challenge. We've just been talking about that. Bogged down in hyper-partisanship, let's just say, without belaboring it, that that system doesn't work anymore. Book ends with some hope, but Kirkpatrick Sale is an important voice. He goes back 50 years, an original founder of the Students for Democratic Society. He is the prophet who warned about the power shift in the United States. That was the title of his book, how things had moved from a locus of power dominated by the Northeast down to the Sun Belt. And then for me, the most powerful book that he has written is Human Scale, which is kind of biblical for me, about how our communities, our lifestyles need to be oriented away from the automobile and mass transit and more towards what is walkable, what is sustainable, what is breathable, what facilitates us acting and interacting as human beings. I challenge the book in some ways. I'm the optimist in the room, and I wrote a very favorable review of his book for Amazon that was just put up yesterday. However, Kirkpatrick Sale, when he issues a warning, should be paid attention to. And I do believe that over the long haul, we've been on a wrong track, and that time is getting late for us to act and get back on the wrong on the right track. What'd you think?
Well, I thought the book was well laid out. I mean, 40 pages we're talking. I mean, yeah. I read it in about an hour and a half. I'll work backwards with the economic collapse, the dollar collapse. I think very convincing. You just only have to point to one fact. I mean, the dollar, by the way, has been the world's reserve currency since 1945. In world history, there has only been a phenomenon of world reserve currency. That's where most of the people in throughout the world use a currency for mm-hmm. trade, for international trade. I believe the first were the Portuguese, and then the Spanish, and then the Dutch, and then the French, and then the British. And if you go by that trend, each world reserve currency only has a shelf life of about 75 to a little over 100 years. And then it collapses, and then a new one takes place. And so just by doing the simple math, 1945 to present, I mean, we're in that territory. And so there's a lot of talk about what will replace the dollar. And, there are two options. One is what the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, called special drawing rights. It's a basket of national currencies, including the pound, the Japanese yen, the Chinese yuan, most recently the dollar and the euro. Or there's just the alternative of what some financial, I would say, investors and analysts, and this would not be a popular view, but in the alternative world, think that any moment now, China is going to announce that it owns 20,000 tons of gold. Because if you've watched what they've been doing over the course of the last 5 to 6 years, China has been buying gold, along with Russia and other challenging nations that want to increasingly separate themselves from this dollar system. And that once China, announces that, that's the ultimate world reserve currency, a gold-backed yuan, and who wouldn't ditch the paper dollar, which is really backed by nothing other than confidence? Who wouldn't flock towards that? So that was on the economic front. On the political front, he cites, all the wars, all the conflicts. There are an increasing amount of conflicts between nations. So there's that. And then, of course, in the U.S., we're divided. And he talks about the 2016 election and the fact that there's an entire half of the country that hasn't accepted, hasn't come to terms with it. You have a similar phenomenon in England with Brexit. So that's on the political front. On the ecological front, I was a little bit, I don't want to say disappointed. He talks mainly about CO2 and the aspect of global warming. I think there's still a debate. There's no debate over whether there's climate change. There is no doubt about it, climate change. What I think needs to be debated is what is the source of climate change. I am not convinced that it is entirely CO2. I've found it very interesting that what I've been researching is the notion of the sun, and that there are cycles of the sun, solar maximums and solar minimums. And, you know, for example, shortly after Rome collapsed, and this, there wasn't a correlation here, but shortly after Rome collapsed, the earth went into a cooling phase, and then it warmed up around the time of 1000. And then about the 1300s, it went back into a cooling phase, and which precipitated in famine and which brought about pestilence, hence why the Black Death wrought havoc. And that today, some argue we could be entering a cooling phase. And I'd say, you know, that could bring some, you know, aspects of crop failure, depending on how devastating or how much of a solar minimum we go into. Another thing I was surprised that he didn't talk about regarding an ecological disaster is the depletion of the topsoil. And that since 1945, you know, chemicals like glyphosate, you know, more popularly known as Roundup, which is was produced by Monsanto, now produced by Bayer, and other herbicides, insecticides, fungicides, and pesticides have been overly used and are depleting the topsoil. Now, I just laid out a lot, and let me just say that what gives me room for hope is that there are a lot of farmers, and I'm blessed to have a few very dear friends of mine who are organic farmers who are practicing steeped in regenerative agriculture, which is, you know, replenishing the soil through methods of basically, you know, not only utilizing the crops to eat and sell, but to also put back into the earth to make it more nutritious. And one farmer was telling me, my dear friend Luke, I'll just say his name, he comes from a family of Swiss farmers. He told me that if you had just a small enough percentage of farmers, maybe 1-3%, you could feed tens of millions of people with this regenerative style of farming. And, you know, if more and more farmers were to do it, it doesn't have to be every farmer or a majority of farmers. It has to be just a small enough percentage. We could avoid any devastation via the disintegration or the depletion of the topsoil.
Well, one of the reasons why I love doing this podcast with you is because I get to have the last word. You know, regardless of the cause of global warming, the fact is that global warming is taking place, and that the consensus among responsible scientists is that man-made global warming is at least a major contributor to that fact. Certainly, there's broad climatic changes that have taken place over the epochs of history, but we are continuing and accelerating whatever global warming is taking place, and that the impact of that is being seen already, was projected to be appearing over the last couple of decades and accelerating during this past decade, and will continue to accelerate unless action is taken place. And that finally, that we simply can't afford to debate action or inaction on the basis of who caused it. We've got to do something before those polar ice caps melt, before those sea levels rise, before droughts accelerate and take place, before populations shift, before diseases spread, before what now is already a mass migration of refugees that are climate related come to points where virtually nothing can be done. And so in that sense, I end up with hope and agreement that regardless of what the cause may be, actions are being taken place. Some behaviors are changing, but that we need widespread agreement and a global master plan to ultimately slow this process down.
Well, I would just ask the question: if we don't know the cause, how do we solve the issue? And who has more of an impact on this earth, the sun or humans?
Well, let's say both. There are some things that we can do. At least that's what science tells us. And on that note, unless you have anything else, let's sign off. And what we have to encourage people, number one, to listen to this podcast, tell us whether they like it or don't like it, and share it around. And then please remind folks about the Intelligencer.
Yes, please check out the Main Street, K Street Intelligencer. We are on issue 2. It came out last Monday. Of course, if you haven't read it by now and it's Friday, it doesn't matter, because this looks to the future. This kind of information has shelf life, but we encourage you not to postpone it any further. Check it out. Tell us what you think and share it. We provide data, trend analysis, the sources of the information that we use, historical context, and of course, what to do with the information. I don't think that there are too many outlets that provide all of that. So signing off week 24, we'll see you next week on week 25. Take care, everyone.
We'll see you next week. And Jer, I'll see you Father's Day, if not before.
Happy Father's Day.
Take care. Bye-bye.